50, we found almost no spirit of competition. A few retailers were scattered around the square, but each of them had sort of carved out their niche, and that was that. If a store didn't have something the customer wanted, he or she would just have to drive to Rogers or Springdale, or very possibly on into Fayetteville. Using some of the things we had learned in Newport, I'd have to say we changed that way of thinking right off and generally sparked up the atmosphere around town. Alice Walton. Saturdays around the Bentonville Square were really something special. Dad always had something going on out on the sidewalks or even in the streets, and there was always a crowd. That's where Santa Claus would come, and that's where we had all the parades. To me, as a kid, it seemed like we had a circus or a carnival going on almost every weekend. I loved Saturdays. I had my popcorn machine out on the sidewalk, and I was covered up in business. Everybody wanted some of that popcorn. And, of course, a lot of my customers would go on into the store. It was a great way to grow up. As you recall, Fayetteville was where we opened our second store after Bentonville, and it was also where we encountered our first discounter competition, Gibson's. We knew from then on that the retail business was going to be changing in major ways for years to come, and we wanted to be part of it. We knew early on that variety stores weren't going to be as big a factor in the future as they had been in the past, and we were heavily invested in them. The important thing to recognize, though, is that none of this was taking place in a vacuum. In the 50s and 60s, everything about America was changing rapidly. All the kids who had grown up on farms and in small towns had come home from World War II or Korea and moved to the cities, where all the jobs were. Except they weren't really moving to the cities, they were moving to the suburbs and commuting into the cities to work. It seemed like every family had at least one car, and many had two, and the country had started building its interstate highway system, all of which changed a lot of the traditional ways Americans were accustomed to doing business. The downtowns of big cities started to lose population and business to the suburbs, and the big downtown department stores had to follow their customers and build branch stores out in the suburban malls. Traditional diners and cafes suffered because of the new car-oriented chains like McDonald's and Burger King. And the old city variety stores like Woolworth's and McCrory's just got smashed by Kmart and some of the other big discounters. The oil companies stuck several service stations on practically every other corner, and pretty soon something called convenience stores, 7-Elevens and such, came along and started filling up the other corners. It was when all this began that Bud and I had opened that Ben Franklin and the shopping center at Ruskin Heights, that big new subdivision community outside Kansas City. For the most part, up where we were, in the small towns of northwest Arkansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Kansas, you didn't see much of the mall construction and fast food neon that you saw everywhere else. McDonald's didn't go into the small towns, and neither did Kmart. You saw the small town commercial centers start to sort of shrivel up. A lot of our customer base had moved on, and the ones who remained behind weren't stupid consumers. If they had something big to buy, say a riding lawnmower, they wouldn't hesitate to drive 50 miles to get it if they thought they could save $100. Not only that, but with the introduction of TV and new post-war car models, being modern had become a big thing. Everybody wanted to feel up to date. And if they knew Kroger or somebody had a big new grocery store in Tulsa or somewhere, they'd drive in there to shop it. When they saw that the prices were lower and the selection was better, they would go back again and again until somebody brought a supermarket to their town. It was this kind of strong customer demand in the small towns that made it possible for Walmart to get started in the first place, that enabled our stores to thrive immediately. and that eventually made it possible to spread the idea pretty much all over the country. For many years, we lived entirely off the principle that customers in the country and in small towns are just like their relatives who left the farm and moved to the city. They want a good deal as much as anybody. When we arrived in these little towns offering low prices every day, satisfaction guaranteed, and hours that were realistic for the way people wanted to shop, we passed right by that old variety store competition with its 45% markups, limited selection, and limited hours. Walmart number 18 is as good an example as there is of how it worked. That store opened in 1969, and it marked our return to Newport, Arkansas, 19 years after we had basically been run out of town. By then, I was long over what had happened to us down there, and I didn't have revenge in mind. It was a logical town for us to expand into, and I admit that it did feel mighty good to be back in business down there. I knew it was a town where we would do well. As it happened, we did extraordinarily well with our Newport Walmart, and it wasn't too long before the old Ben Franklin store I had run on Front Street had to close its doors. You can't say we ran that guy, the landlord's son, out of business. His customers were the ones who shut him down. They voted with their feet. Quite a few smaller stores have gone out of business during the time of Walmart's growth. Some people have tried to turn it into this big controversy, sort of a save-the-small-town merchants deal, like they were whales or whooping cranes or something that has the right to be protected. Of all the notions I've heard about Walmart, none has ever baffled me more than this idea that we are somehow the enemy of small-town America. Nothing could be further from the truth. Walmart has actually kept quite a number of small towns from becoming practically extinct by offering low prices and saving literally billions of dollars for the people who live there, as well as by creating hundreds of thousands of jobs in our stores. I don't have any trouble understanding why some merchant who's having a hard time competing with us wouldn't be too happy about our being there. What I haven't been able to figure at all is these people who have decided we're somehow responsible for the decline of the small town. My guess is that a lot of these critics are folks who grew up in small towns and then deserted them for the big cities decades ago. Now, when they come home for a visit, it makes them sad that the old town square isn't exactly like it was when they left it back in 1954. It's almost like they want their hometown to be stuck in time, an old-fashioned place filled with old-fashioned people doing business the old-fashioned way. Somehow, small-town populations weren't supposed to move out into their own suburbs, and they weren't supposed to go out to the intersections of highways and build malls with lots of free parking. That's just not the way some of these folks remember their old towns. But folks who grew up in big cities feel the same way about what's happened to their cities over the last 40 or 50 years. A lot of the stores and the movie theaters and the restaurants that they remember loving as kids have boarded up and either gone out of business or moved to the suburbs, too. I think what happened to Walmart in all this is that we got to be a certain size and became so well known as the small-town merchants that we became an easy target. Certain folks figured they could create a niche for themselves, a platform from which to express their views about small-town America, by zeroing in on us. The whole thing taught me a lesson about the way the national media seems to think. When you start out as an unknown quantity with just a dream and a commitment, you couldn't buy a mention of your company in one of these publications. When you become moderately successful, they still ignore you unless something bad happens to you. Then, the more successful you become, the more suspicious they become of you. And if you ever become a large-scale success, it's Katie bar the door. Suddenly, you make a very convenient villain because everybody seems to love shooting at who's on top. As an old-time small-town merchant, I can tell you that nobody has more love for the heyday of the small-town retailing era than I do. That's one of the reasons we chose to put our little Walmart museum on the square in Bentonville. It's in the old Walton's Five and Dime building, and it tries to capture a little bit of the old dime store feel. But I can also tell you this. If we'd gotten smug about our early success and said, well, we're the best merchant in town, and just kept doing everything exactly the way we were doing it, somebody else would have come along and given our customers what they wanted, and we would be out of business today. I don't know who it would have been. Maybe Gibson's or TG&Y would have pulled it off, but I suspect it would have been a combination of Kmart and Target, which, like McDonald's, would have rolled out into the small towns once they began to saturate their big city markets. What happened was absolutely a necessary and inevitable evolution in retailing, as inevitable as the replacement of the buggy by the car and the disappearance of the buggy whip makers. The small stores were just destined to disappear, at least in the numbers they once existed, because the whole thing is driven by the customers, who are free to choose where they shop. Don Soderquist. We've never been very sympathetic to this whole small-town argument. What's happened to the small-town merchant isn't any different from what happened when supermarkets first appeared in the 50s. The whole point of retailing is to serve the customer. If you're a merchant with no competition, you can charge high prices, open late, close early, and shut down on Wednesday and Saturday afternoons. You can do exactly what you've always done, and probably be just fine. But when competition comes along, don't expect your customers to stick with you for old time's sake. There are plenty of ways to compete successfully with Walmart or any other big retailer. The principle behind all those ways is pretty basic. You have to focus on something the customer wants, and then deliver it. I don't want to be too critical of small-town merchants, but the truth is that a lot of these folks just weren't doing a very good job of taking care of their customers before we or somebody else came in and offered something new. And they didn't do a very good job of reacting to our arrival, either. You know, there have been articles and even one little book written on how to compete with us. And I've got a few suggestions of my own. Unless small merchants are already doing a great job, they'll probably have to rethink their merchandising and advertising and promotional programs once a discounter arrives on the scene. They need to avoid coming at us head-on and do their own thing better than we do ours. It doesn't make any sense to try to underprice Walmart on something like toothpaste. That's not what the customer's looking to a small store for anyway. Most independents are best off, I think, doing what I prided myself on doing for so many years as a storekeeper, getting out on the floor and meeting every one of the customers. Let them know how much you appreciate them, and ring that cash register yourself. That little personal touch is so important for an independent merchant, because no matter how hard Walmart tries to duplicate it, and we try awfully hard, we can't really do it. I think in the case of variety stores, they have to completely reposition themselves, something like the way Don Soderquist did when he was president of Ben Franklin. He saw that there just wasn't any future in competing with Walmart and Kmart, so he started converting a lot of their variety stores into craft stores. They offered a much bigger assortment of craft merchandise than any Walmart could, and they held classes in things like pottery and flower arranging, services we could never think about providing. It worked. They stayed in business in the small towns, and have been quite successful with many of those stores. The same thing can be done with fabrics. Offer higher quality material and throw in some sewing classes, or ladies' apparel. I don't care how many Walmarts come to town, there are always niches that we can't reach. Not that we won't try. Just like everybody else, in order to survive, we need to keep changing the things we do. Now, in the case of hardware stores, I don't deny that we've been hard on some of them, too. But if they're in a decent location, they shouldn't have that much trouble with Walmart. It's the one kind of store for which I have the least sympathy because, frankly, a good, smart hardware store operator can just beat us to death if he thinks about what he's doing and commits to putting up a fight. If he gets his assortment right and makes sure his salespeople have excellent knowledge of the products and how to use them, and goes out of his way to take care of his customers, he can keep plenty of business away from us. We don't have nearly the assortment of a hardware store, plumbing supplies and electrical equipment and specialty tools, and not all of our folks can explain how to fix a leaky faucet or rewire a lamp the way folks in a hardware store should be able to. Our paint customers don't get waited on much either. They have to pick out their own paint and then walk around with it looking for the rest of the things they want. The same is true in sporting goods, where the customer can't expect to get nearly the same kind of service from us as from a specialty store. Don Soderquist. I have personally competed with Walmart, so I know it can be done. You develop a uniqueness, a niche, and then you capitalize on it. And let me tell you, not all small merchants in these little towns hate us. Some of them have learned to feed off us rather successfully. Shortly after we opened a Walmart in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, I had a lady come up to me and say, "Oh, I just want to thank you so much for coming here. This is the best thing that could have ever happened." I thanked her and asked her what she did there in town, and she said, "Well, I run a paint store right over there, just down in this mall." She went on to say that the day our store opened turned out to be the biggest day she had ever had since her paint store opened. "You're pulling all these people into our shopping center, and the neatest thing happened to me Saturday. A man came in looking for a particular kind of paint and said he knew we had it. He said he knew because he'd been in the Walmart looking for it, and the paint department manager told him we had it and sent him on over." I thought that was wonderful. Our guy sent the customer along to the paint store because it was the right thing to do. He was taking care of the customer. What makes me sad these days, and a little angry too, is that some of these stores are starting to shut down before we come to a town. They hear we're coming and they close up before we ever even get there. We get a bad rep for that, but to my mind, somebody who'll close his store just because he hears competition's coming is somebody who must know he's not doing much of a job. Somebody who probably shouldn't have been in the retail business to begin with. For all the press about Walmart being at odds with small towns, I am positive that we are most welcome in almost every community where we do business. That's partly because of our economic contribution, but it's also because we go out of our way to instill a sense of community involvement in our store management and associates so that they'll even be better citizens. We know that some of our store managers do a better job at this than others, and it's a constant effort to make everyone work on community involvement. We already have community scholarship programs and matching charity grant programs, but we're working hard every day to improve the ways in which we give back to the communities we're in. If we ever let our sense of being hometown merchants slip too far, we run the risk of damaging what we think is a unique relationship with our customers. When we meet opposition to a prospective store site, we try to work with the opponents to see if we can reasonably satisfy them. Occasionally, we will change a proposed location or make some concessions if they make sense to us. Today, though, we have almost adopted the position that if some community, for whatever reason, doesn't want us in there, we aren't interested in going in and creating a fuss. I encourage us to walk away from this kind of trouble because there are just too many other good towns out there who do want us. For everyone that doesn't, I'd say we have another 200 begging us to come to their town. Walmart wants to go where it's wanted. I've always said that the simplest test of how right we are on this issue would be to go into any town where we've been for a couple of years and let everyone vote on whether they wanted us there or not. My Lord, they'd go crazy if we left. In fact, every now and then, we do have to close up a store someplace because we just can't make it profitable. And the outcry is something awful. It's another part of the price you pay for success. Small-town merchants, by the way, aren't the only groups we've gotten into controversies with by sticking to our philosophy of putting the customer ahead of everything else. On the surface, the idea of serving the customer sounds so simple, so logical, and so obvious. But from the very beginning, the way we have practiced it has been so radical that it has frequently gotten us into trouble with what folks call the system. In the early days, the department stores put a lot of pressure on vendors to keep them from selling to discounters like us because they hated what we were doing, offering our customers prices much lower than theirs. In some states, the department stores used so-called fair trade laws to try and block discounters from doing business at all. Our vendors resented us for prying the lowest prices out of them, and some manufacturers' representatives, independent sales agents, who generally work on commission to represent several different manufacturers, have complained about some of our practices. We don't have any problem with the idea of paying a middleman a commission on a sale if his services add value to the purchasing process by making it more efficient. But from the days when I was hauling that little trailer over into Tennessee to buy panties and shirts and avoid paying Butler Brothers markup, our philosophy on this has always been simple. We are the agents for our customers. And to do the best job possible, we've got to become the most efficient deliverer of merchandise that we can. Sometimes that can best be accomplished by purchasing goods directly from the manufacturer. And other times, direct purchase simply doesn't work. In those cases, we need to use middlemen to deal with smaller manufacturers and make the process more efficient. What we believe in strongly is our right to make that decision, whether to buy directly or from a rep, based on what it takes to best serve our customers. This controversy is another case, I think, of a group of people believing for some reason that they're just entitled to take a piece of the action no matter how little they contribute to the transaction or what it means to the customer. The argument is as simple as the small-town merchant controversy. If American business is going to prevail and be competitive, we're going to have to get accustomed to the idea that business conditions change and that survivors have to adapt to those changing conditions. Business is a competitive endeavor, and job security lasts only as long as the customer is satisfied. Nobody owes anybody else a living. To understand Walmart's point of view on middlemen and our relationship with our vendors, you have to look back to our beginnings in the discount business. In the early days of the industry, most discounters were served entirely by middlemen, jobbers, or distributors who came in and said to those old promoters, "We'll keep your shelves filled for 15% of the gross." In other words, the price on every item included a 15% commission to the jobber for supplying the merchandise. That's how the fast buck promoters got into the business without even having to think much like merchants. They took what the jobbers gave them, added on the 15%, and still underpriced the department stores by a long shot. But, as I mentioned, we couldn't find anybody who wanted to run their trucks 60 or 70 miles out of the way into these little towns where we were operating. We were totally ignored by the distributors and the jobbers. That's not only how we came to build our own distribution system, it's also how we got used to beating the heck out of everybody on prices. We had a time getting good merchandise for our stores back then, but our cost of acquiring the goods was rock bottom, because we sat out there with absolutely no help from distributors. And because we got used to doing everything on our own, we have always resented paying anyone just for the pleasure of doing business with him. Claude Harris. There's a difference between being tough and being obnoxious. But every buyer has to be tough. That's the job. I always told the buyers, you're not negotiating for Walmart, you're negotiating for your customer. And your customer deserves the best price you can get. Don't ever feel sorry for a vendor. He knows what he can sell for, and we want his bottom price. And that's what we did, and what Walmart still does. We could tell the vendors, don't leave in any room for a kickback, because we don't do that here. And we don't want your advertising program or your delivery program. Our truck will pick it up at your warehouse. Now, what is your best price? And if they told me it's a dollar, I would say, fine, I'll consider it. But I'm going to go to your competitor, and if he says 90 cents, he's going to get the business. So make sure a dollar is your best price. If that's being hard-nosed, then we ought to be as hard-nosed as we can be. You have to be fair and upfront and honest, but you have to drive your bargain because you're dealing for millions and millions of customers who expect the best price they can get. If you buy that thing for $1.25, you've just bought somebody else's inefficiency. We used to get into some terrific fights. You have to be just as tough as they are. You can't let them get by with anything because they're going to take care of themselves, and your job is to take care of the customer. I'd threaten Procter & Gamble with not carrying their merchandise, and they'd say, oh, you can't get by without carrying our merchandise. And I'd say, you watch me put it on a side counter, and I'll put Colgate on the end cap at a penny less, and you just watch me. They got offended and went to Sam, and he said, whatever Claude says, that's what it's going to be. Well, now we have a real good relationship with Procter & Gamble. It's a model that everybody talks about. But let me tell you, one reason for that is that they learned to respect us. They learned if they couldn't bulldoze us like everybody else, and that when we said we were representing the customer, we were dead serious. In those days, of course, we desperately needed Procter & Gamble's product, whereas they could have gotten along just fine without us. Today, we are their largest customer. But it really wasn't until 1987 that we began to turn a basically adversarial vendor-retailer relationship into one that we like to think is the wave of the future. A win-win partnership between two big companies, both trying to serve the same customer. Believe it or not, as big as we had become by then, I don't believe Walmart had ever been called on by a corporate officer of P&G. We just let our buyers slug it out with their salesmen, and both sides lived with the results. Then one day, my close friend and longtime tennis buddy here in Bentonville, George Billingsley, called me up and asked me to join him on a canoe trip down the Spring River. He said he was bringing along an old friend named Lou Pritchett, who was a vice president with P&G at the time, and who wanted to meet me and talk about some things relating to our two companies. So I went along, and it turned out to be the most productive float trip I ever took with George. Lou Pritchett. During that time on the river, we both decided that the entire relationship between vendor and retailer was at issue. Both focused on the end user, the customer. But each did it independently of the other. No sharing of information, no planning together, no systems coordination. We were simply two giant entities going our separate ways, oblivious to the excess costs created by this obsolete system. We were communicating, in effect, by slipping notes under the door. As a result, we assembled the top 10 officers of both companies in Bentonville for 2 days of soul-searching and thinking, and within 3 months we had created a PNG/Walmart team to build a whole new kind of vendor-retailer relationship. We formed a partnership to conduct our business, with one of the most important outcomes being that we started sharing information by computer. P&G could monitor Walmart sales and inventory data, and then use that information to make its own production and shipping plans with a great deal more efficiency. We broke new ground by using information technology to manage our business together, instead of just to audit it. Following the P&G/Walmart partnership, many other companies began to view the supplier as an important partner. The partnership was also a model for many of our other vendor relationships. In our situation today, we are obsessed with quality as well as price. And as big as we are, the only way we can possibly get that combination is to sit down with our vendors and work out the costs and margins and plan everything together. By doing that, we give the manufacturer the advantage of knowing what our needs are going to be a year out or 6 months out, or even 2 years out. Then, as long as they are honest with us and try to lower their costs as much as they can, and keep turning out a product that the customers want, we can stay with them. We both win, and most important, the customer wins too. The added efficiency of the whole process enables the manufacturer to reduce its costs, which allows us to lower our prices. One thing we don't ever want to do, though, is let all these complex strategic issues between us and other big companies, or these controversies like small-town merchants and middlemen, get in the way of our thinking like customers, which may be the most basic way in which we make the customer number one. David Glass. I was in a store recently where a manager and an assistant manager were taking a department manager through her department. They were saying, "If you were a customer, how would you buy that item?" She was cramped for space and had put this item out of reach of the average customer, and they kept going, "If you were a customer, what related items would you want to buy with this? And how would you find them?" I loved it. So many times we overcomplicate this business. You can take computer reports, velocity reports, any kind of reports you want to, and go lay out your counters by computer. But if you simply think like a customer, you will do a better job of merchandise presentation and selection than any other way. It's not always easy to think like a customer. You have to think about details. Whoever said retail is detail is absolutely 100% right. On the other hand, it's simple. If the customers are the bosses, all you have to do is please them. I couldn't agree with David more. Everything we've done since we started Walmart has been devoted to this idea that the customer is our boss. The controversies it has led us into have surprised me, but they've been easy to live with because we have never doubted our philosophy that the customer comes ahead of everything else. Chapter 13. Meeting the Competition. Sam phoned to tell me he was going to start a wholesale club. It was no surprise. He is notorious for looking at what everybody else does, taking the best of it, and then making it better. Saul Price, founder 1955 FedMart, and founder 1976 Price Club. I don't know what would have happened to Walmart if we had laid low and never stirred up the competition. My guess is that we would have remained a strictly regional operator. Then eventually I think we would have been forced to sell out to some national chain, looking for a quick way to expand into the Heartland market. Maybe there would have been 100 or 150 Walmarts on the street for a while, but today they would all have Kmart or Target signs in front of them, and I would have become a full-time bird hunter. We'll never know because we chose the other route. We decided that instead of avoiding our competitors or waiting for them to come to us, we would meet them head-on. It was one of the smartest strategic decisions we ever made. In fact, if our story doesn't prove anything else about the free market system, it erases any doubt that spirited competition is good for business. Not just customers, but the companies which have to compete with one another, too. Our competitors have honed and sharpened us to an edge we wouldn't have without them. We wouldn't be nearly as good as we are today without Kmart, and I think they would admit we've made them a better retailer. One reason Sears fell so far off the pace is that they wouldn't admit for the longest time that Walmart and Kmart were the real competition. They ignored both of us, and we both blew right by them. Bud Walton. Competition is very definitely what made Walmart from the very beginning. There's not an individual in these whole United States who has been in more retail stores. All types of retail stores, too, not just discount stores, than Sam Walton. Make that all over the world. He's been in stores in Australia and South America, Europe and Asia and South Africa. His mind is just so inquisitive when it comes to this business. And there may not be anything he enjoys more than going into a competitor's store trying to learn something from it. At first, we only butted heads with other regional discounters, like Gibson's and the Magic Mart discount division of Sterling. We didn't compete directly with Kmart. To put things into perspective, compare Kmart and Walmart after they had both been on the street for 10 years. Our 50-plus Walmarts and 11 variety stores were doing about $80 million a year in sales compared to Kmart's 500 stores doing more than $3 billion a year. But Kmart had interested me ever since the first store went up in 1962. I was in their stores constantly because they were the laboratory and they were better than we were. I spent a heck of a lot of my time wandering through their stores, talking to their people, and trying to figure out how they did things. For a long time, I'd been itching to try our luck against them, and finally, in 1972, we saw a perfect opportunity in Hot Springs, Arkansas. A much larger city than we were accustomed to moving into, but still close to home and full of customers we understood. We saw Kmart sitting there all alone, really having their way with the market. They had no competition, and their prices and margins were so high that they almost weren't even discounting. We sent Phil Green in to open store number 52, which you may remember, as where we stirred up all the fuss with the world's largest Tide display and all his other outrageous promotions. He cut prices to the bone and stole a bunch of Kmart's customers. Coincidentally, it was right about that time that Harry Cunningham chose to retire as the CEO of Kmart, which he had founded while he was chairman of S.S. Kresge. This was a big break for us. Harry was really the guy who, in just 10 years, had legitimized the discount industry and made Kmart into the model for us all. Although my good friend, John Geis, who helped found the Target and Venture stores, was another pioneer way ahead of his time. Harry Cunningham. From the time anybody first noticed Sam, it was obvious he had adopted almost all of the original Kmart ideas. I always had great admiration for the way he implemented, and later enlarged on, those ideas. Much later on, when I was retired but still a Kmart board member, I tried to advise the company's management of just what a serious threat I thought he was. But it wasn't until fairly recently that they took him seriously. I guess we really were a flea attacking an elephant, and the elephant didn't respond right away. Maybe Harry's right. Maybe they didn't take us seriously until much later. But I always believed it made them mad, our going in on them like that in Hot Springs. Just a few years later, around 1976 and 1977, we definitely got the message that Kmart, with 1,000 stores, thought Walmart, with 150, had gotten too big for its britches. All of a sudden, they took a direct shot right into our backyard by opening up in four of our better towns. Jefferson City and Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and Fayetteville and Rogers, Arkansas. They were expanding like that all over the country at the time, and all the regional discounters were worried. In 1976, we had a session of our discounters trade group in Phoenix, and a lot of guys were talking about ways to avoid competing with Kmart directly. I got a little mad and told everybody they ought to stand up and fight them. I made it clear we planned to. Herb Fisher, founder, chairman, and CEO, James Way Corporation. Kmart was opening so many stores, it was regarded as the Genghis Khan of the discounting business. Sam has always been clear about his attitude, meet them head on. Competition will make us a better company. He's that way with everyone. Personally, he's such a fine, unassuming, quiet gentleman, but he's always picking your brain, and he always has a notebook or that tape recorder. He'll learn everything you know, but he shares his information freely with you in return. Now, of course, he's a competitor to James Way, but he wouldn't ever apologize for that. He thinks it makes us a better company. And he's right. Something else happened in late 1976 which really helped us gear up for competition. A research group set up by a bunch of us regional discounters, who at the time didn't compete in each other's territories, had its first meeting here in Bentonville. Guys like Herb Fisher of James Way and Herb Gilman of Ames and Dale Warman of Fred Meyer all came down here and went through our stores to give us their opinion of how they thought we were doing. And man, what they had to say really shocked us. Nick White, Executive Vice President, Walmart. Bill Fields was running the Rogers store, Dean Sanders was running Siloam Springs, and I was running Springdale, all close to Bentonville, so we were all on the tour. These guys, the presidents of all these companies, they just ripped our stores apart, telling us how poorly we did everything. The signing isn't worth a damn. You've got your prices too high on this. This stuff isn't even priced. You've got too much of this and not enough of that. I mean, it was really critical. That was really a turning point in our business. We listened to everything they had to say and made huge adjustments based on those critiques. It helped us gear up for any competition, especially Kmart, whose attack on us was probably the best single external event in Walmart's history. We pulled ourselves together and designed a big plan, a promotional program, and a people program, and a merchandising program for how we were going to react. Since our run on Kmart in Hot Springs had turned out well, we were confident we could compete. Thomas Jefferson. Kmart really took us on in about 1977, and I remember Little Rock particularly. They took us on there in North Little Rock, where store number 7 had been one of our better stores. They got aggressive, and we fought back. We told our manager there, no matter what, don't let them undersell you at all on anything. I remember he called me one Saturday night and said, you know, we have Crest toothpaste down to 6 cents a tube now. And I said, well, just keep it there and see what they do. They didn't lower it any more than that, and we both just kept it at 6 cents. Finally, they backed off. I always thought they learned something about us at that store, that we don't bend easy. Because they never came at us with that degree of price cutting anywhere else. We got so much better so quickly it was hard to believe. We totally stood Kmart off in those small towns of ours. Almost from the beginning, they weren't very successful at taking our customers away in Jeff City and Poplar Bluff. Once Kmart arrived, we worked even harder at pleasing our customers. And they stayed loyal. This gave us a great surge of confidence in ourselves. But at the time, remember, our sales were about 5% of Kmart's, and we had recently suffered that exodus of executives following the Ron Mayer departure. So we were having a heck of a time convincing Wall Street to stick with us. A lot of people didn't think we could stand up to real competition. One analyst, Margot Alexander of Mitchell Hutchins Incorporated, really worried about the exodus in her report on Walmart. She wondered if it wouldn't discourage other executives from coming on board. She said they might see an inevitable conflict with the entrepreneur who will never be satisfied with another person running his company. In other words, me. She also questioned whether I, having retired once, was as committed to running the business as I had been previously. Here's some of what she wrote about us in January of 1977. One of the key elements in Walmart's success has been the lack of competition in its small rural markets. It is clearly easier to operate in this kind of situation rather than in a competitive one. Pricing need not be so sharp, and the right merchandise is less critical simply because customers have no alternative. Although Walmart says its stores compete effectively against Kmart, the company will avoid a Kmart if possible. While we don't expect Kresge to stage any massive invasion of Walmart's existing territory, Kresge could logically act to contain Walmart's geographical expansion. Assuming some containment policy on Kresge's part, Walmart could run into serious problems in the next few years. We would very much like to recommend purchase of the stock. Unfortunately, however, the future of the company appears uncertain, and we think that Walmart is one of those threshold companies that runs the risk of stumbling. Reports like that one didn't help us much, but the truth is that her analysis of the situation wasn't necessarily as wrong as it looks today. All those things could have come true. She missed a few key points, though. Her biggest mistake was the uncertainty she felt about the management team that followed Ron Mayer. As I said earlier, having David Glass and Jack Shoemaker both on board in senior positions gave us about as much talent under one roof as any one retailer could ever hope to have. In recent years, I've taken a lot of pride in the fact that our fastest expansion, the greatest growth period in the history of retail, actually came after everybody thought our goose was cooked and ready to be eaten by the Kmart folks from Detroit. Another point missed by Margot Alexander and others was that a very fortunate thing happened to us on the competitive front. Kmart was developing its own problems. During the end of 1976, they had purchased more than 200 store locations left over from the defunct Grant's chain, and they had their hands full trying to make that work. Not only that, they seemed to have a management philosophy at the time of avoiding all change, something that never works in this business. I'm sure that worrying about Walmart fell way down on their priority list, and I occasionally think back to how lucky we were not to have had to face Harry Cunningham, or Kmart's current management team, during that period. Regardless of what was going on at Kmart, the new team we had in place in Bentonville by the late 70s had us well positioned for the next decade of growth. It was around this time that many of the high-flying promoters in the discounting business began to struggle for their lives. The national economy weakened in the mid-70s, and the intense competition among the real merchants began to drive the fast-buck types out of the business. The more efficient Kmart, Target, Walmart, and some of the regionals became, and the more we bumped into each other in competitive situations, the more we were able to lower prices. The percentage of gross margin in this industry, really the markup on merchandise, has dropped steadily from around 35% in the early 60s to only 22% today. Almost all of that represents increased value and savings to the customers who shop discount stores. So the guys who weren't running efficient operations, who had taken on lots of debt and were living high and not taking care of their associates, who weren't scrambling around to get the best deals on merchandise and passing those deals on to their customers, these guys got into trouble. When we saw Kmart headed right after us in 1976 and 1977, we decided we could pick up some speed in our expansion efforts by acquiring some struggling discounters. Because Walmart had always been such a homegrown operation, this whole period sparked a lot of philosophical debate around our offices, and frankly, I changed sides so often that I drove everybody involved pretty crazy. I didn't have many problems at all with our first real acquisition, which came in 1977. My brother Bud and David Glass negotiated a deal to buy a small chain called More Value Discount Stores up in Illinois. Their stores had been averaging $3 million to $5 million a year per store, and it seemed like a good way to put a beachhead into some new territory. We closed 5 stores and converted the remaining 16 to Walmarts, and it wasn't much of a shock to our system. It sure didn't slow us down any, because 2 years later in 1979, with about 230 stores on the street, we hit $1 billion in sales for the first time. Of all the milestones we ever reached, that one probably impressed me the most. I have to admit, I was amazed that Walmart had turned into a billion-dollar company. But I couldn't see any logic to stopping there, and right about then, another acquisition opportunity came our way. This one was a good bit more disruptive, but it helped us make a geographic leap that was very important to our expansions. A lot of people back east who didn't know much about Walmart still think of us today as a southern discount operator. Maybe it's because we're in Arkansas, which most people think of as a southern state, even though where we are is really more Midwestern. Or maybe it's because of our down-home image. But the truth is that until 1981, we had almost no stores east of the Mississippi. We were big in Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, but had nothing in Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, or the Carolinas. We weren't much of a competitor in the South at all. On the other hand, Coon's Big K stores had become a good-sized player in the South. Based in Nashville, Tennessee, Coon's had started as a single variety store back somewhere before 1920. Jack Coon and his brother Gus had converted the company into a discounter, made an acquisition or two, and grown it into a chain of 112 stores, concentrated in Tennessee but also doing business in Kentucky, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. All states where we thought we could do well. We were a good bit bigger than they were, but the two of us had been watching each other pretty closely. It was sort of like the old variety store days when one chain, like TGNY, wouldn't go into the territory of another chain, like Hested's. We knew that one way or another we had to head on into the south, and I guess we stirred them up by crossing the Mississippi and opening a store in Jackson, Tennessee. They retaliated by opening stores in West Helena and Blytheville, Arkansas. The truth is, we were closing in on Coons and really doing a better job than they were. In fact, they were beginning to falter. They had taken on some debt and built a fancy headquarters building, and they were showing some losses. I had a heck of a time making up my mind what to do. I wanted to get into that territory before Kmart or somebody else woke up and stole our thunder there. It seemed like a great competitive move to make, but we'd never bitten off anything close to this size before, and we didn't know what it would be like trying to digest it. We went round and round on it. We were on again, off again, for probably 2 years. Finally, the executive committee sat down to vote on it one morning, and it came out split right down the middle, 50-50. It was just as well because it gave me the opportunity to take the ultimate responsibility for the decision. The whole thing had been really cloudy all along with a lot of arguing. Finally, I voted to do it. We didn't know how to go about folding Coons into Walmart, but we put Paul Carter in charge, and he commuted back and forth between Nashville and Bentonville for quite a while. Paul Carter, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, Walmart. It was one of the few times we ever saw the chairman use his prerogative and say, "We are going to do this." It was a new kind of proposition for Walmart. At first, we thought we were going to run everything from Nashville as a separate division. Then we changed our minds and decided to close all their offices down and bring everything over here. It was the furthest out we'd ever been geographically, and looking back, I guess the decision to run it from here had a big influence on how we've run the company ever since, with all the regional managers based in Bentonville. I went over there to Big K, weighing 190 pounds, and came back at 165. It was a struggle for all of us involved, and a stretch for the whole company. But I'm not sure that's not good for every organization at some point. Jack Shoemaker took the situation as an opportunity to learn and implement a lot about communications in a spread-out situation. Hard as it was, the Big K thing was really good for this company. It was like a caterpillar that turns into a butterfly. As a company, we were really ready to fly after we emerged from that one. We closed down some of Coon's money-losing stores, and for the first time we tried to supply our stores using an outside company, a third-party distributor, which didn't work at all. But once we figured out how to handle it, the acquisition put us in a great position for growth. We exploded from that point on, almost always opening 100 new stores a year, and more than 150 in some years. I think the Coons deal gave us a new confidence that we could conquer anything. I don't know how the folks around our executive offices see me, and I know they get frustrated with the way I make everybody go back and forth on so many issues that come up. But I see myself as being a little more inclined than most of them are to take chances. On something like the Coons decision, I try to play a what-if game with the numbers. But it's generally my gut that makes the final decision. If it feels right, I tend to go for it. And if it doesn't, I back off. Sometimes, of course, that leads me into mistakes. Back in the early 80s, for example, I traveled all over the world looking at global competition in retailing. I went to Germany, France, Italy, South Africa, Great Britain, Australia, and South America, and saw several concepts which interested me. I was impressed with the giant Carrefour stores in Brazil, which got me started on a campaign to bring home a concept called Hypermart. Giant stores with groceries and general merchandise under one roof. I checked them out in Europe and came back pushing the concept hard. I agreed that everybody except the U.S. was successful with this concept, and we should get in on the ground floor with it. I was certain this was where the next competitive battlefield would be. Eventually, we opened two hypermarts in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, one in Topeka, and one in Kansas City. By now, we had gotten enough respect in the business so that Kmart jumped right in behind us with their own hypermart concept called American Fair. Our hypermarts weren't disasters, but they were disappointments. They were marginally profitable stores, and they taught us what our next step should be in combining grocery and general merchandising. A smaller concept called the Supercenter. But I was mistaken in my vision of the potential the hypermart held in this country. We conducted other similar but less publicized experiments that didn't work out so well either. Our dot discount drug concept grew to 25 stores before we decided it wasn't going to be profitable enough. And we tried one home improvement center called Save More in the building, which had housed the original Walmart in Rogers, which was also not a success. As David Glass says about me, once I decide I'm wrong, I'm ready to move on to something else. But when one of our experiments works, watch out. Take Sam's Clubs, for example. It was an experiment when we started it up in 1983, and now 9 years later, it's a $10 billion business with more than 217 stores and terrific growth potential. Sam's are big stores in warehouse-type buildings aimed at small business owners and other customers who buy merchandise in bulk. A membership fee entitles a customer to shop at Sam's, which charges wholesale prices for name brand, often high-end merchandise. Everything from tires to cameras to watches to office supplies to cocktail sausages and soft drinks. If you've never been in one, they're a lot of fun to shop, and the people who work there are a little crazy. Like the old days at Walmart, they're liable to do anything on a moment's notice to move the merchandise. Just like discounting, I'm sorry to say we can't take any of the credit for inventing the wholesale club concept. Put yourself in our position for a moment, though, and you can see why we had to steal the idea from those who did roll it out. It was the early 80s, and we'd been in the discount business for around 20 years. Only the efficient operators were still in business, because prices and margins had been falling steadily the whole time. Suddenly, we noticed a whole new class of sub-discounter undercutting our prices. Wholesalers with very low overhead, who were selling at margins way below the 22% in the discount business, 5-7%. Since low prices every day had brought us this far, we had to explore the business. Especially since we knew that Saul Price, one of the original discount pioneers, was behind this idea. He had started his Price Club stores in 1976. So one day in 1983, I went to see Saul in San Diego. I had met him earlier when my son Rob and I called on him. This time, though, Helen and I were out on the West Coast already for a meeting of the mass merchandisers, so we dropped down to have dinner with Saul and his wife Helen at Lubach's. And I admit it, I didn't tell him at the time that I was going to copy his program, but that's what I did. I came home and went over to Oklahoma City, where we rented an old building for about 90 cents a square foot, or maybe even 75 cents. We remodeled it, and to manage it, put together a pickup crew of mavericks who were sort of underappreciated at Walmart. We had two or three buyers. We whipped up a program and a design and put the whole thing in motion. We opened our first club in 1983. It had that same feel of chaos and excitement as the early days at Walmart. And we went out of our way from the very beginning to separate the Sam's Club culture from the Walmart culture. One of the guys I picked was Rob Voss. He was not really looked on as a top management talent at Walmart because he was always swimming against the current more than he was going with it. He was a little bit of an agitator. Rob Voss, first general merchandise manager, Sam's Club. I told Sam up front that he had a lot of egos around his company and that they needed to understand we were going to be doing our own merchandising. So he got up at a Saturday morning meeting and told everybody, this is a direct quote, "The Sam's Club operation will be doing their own merchandising. If any of you buyers out here with Walmart take exception to that and feel that because you're the buyer of a category, you should be buying it for the entire company, I suggest you come and visit with me in my office on a one-on-one basis, and then I'll explain it to you in a little more detail." From that day on, we never had a problem. We quickly went on to open Sam's in Kansas City and Dallas, and then two units in Houston. It was a lot like Walmart. Once we had those five units up and going, I knew we could run with it, and we did. I hate to say it, but I guess it was almost what you'd call a second childhood for me, a second challenge anyway. I had a chance to build a company all over again, and I tried to be as hands-on as I could, although David Glass was heavily involved with Sam's from early on, too. Ron Lovelace, retired senior vice president, Walmart. I came over from Walmart to help set up Sam's. Since we were patterned after price clubs, sometimes we copied them without exactly knowing what we were doing. We were bringing a West Coast idea to the Midwest, and we didn't know how it would be received. I remember one idea that didn't transfer too well. Price Club had a huge stack of wine in the front of its stores. We bought the same amount for our stores in the Midwest, and we learned the hard way that Midwesterners aren't exactly wine drinkers. Tom Coughlin, Senior Vice President, Sam's Clubs. This business is fun. It really is. It's so basic, so straightforward. We do no advertising, but our whole business is based on selling the concept. We sell small business operators on the idea that for $25 a year, they can have a just-in-time warehouse with all the same price advantages for goods that large companies get. And just like Walmart, our customers get to know and love our culture. They know there are no frills whatsoever in those warehouses. They know our management people are likely to be the ones to grab the forklift and pull the goods down for them, and they come to expect it and like it. The competition in the club business can get pretty spirited sometimes. Once I was in the Big Price Club on Moreno Avenue in San Diego, and I had my little tape recorder with me like I always do, and I was making notes to myself about prices and merchandising ideas. This guy, a big guy, comes up to me and says, "I'm sorry, but I'll have to take your tape recorder and erase the material you've got on it. We have a policy against people using them in the stores." Well, we have the same policy, and I knew I was caught, so I said, "I respect that, but I've got things on here from other stores that I don't want to lose, so let me write a note to Robert Price." That's Saul's son. So I wrote, "Robert, your guy is just too good. I was trying to get some information on this recorder about some of the items you were carrying and some of my impressions of your store, and he caught me. So here's the tape. If you want to listen to it, you certainly have that privilege. But I have some other material on here I would like very much to have back." So in about 4 days, I got a nice note back from Robert with the tape, and none of it had been blurred or scratched out. He probably treated me better than I deserved. The SAMS launch reflects another part of my management style that applies not only to the competition, but to our own people as well. I like to keep everybody guessing. I don't want our competitors getting too comfortable with feeling like they can predict what we're going to do. And I don't want our own executives feeling that way either.